So we're talking about 91BG likes, and I got into 91BG likes as a postdoc in with Bob Kirshner. 1999 BY went off when I was there, and it's a 91BG like, and so we got lots and lots of spectra. And well, as part of that analysis, we looked at a bunch of other 91BG like. So I'm basically just going to look at that paper that we wrote on 99BY, which had a comparison with other 91BG likes. So 91BG likes, they are type 1A supernovae. They have strong silicon. This is 98BU, a normal type 1A. This is 99BY at the same epoch. So the strong silicon, and even stronger apparently silicon here than here, and that's a very nice indicator for a low luminosity, fast declining supernovae. And then there are differences out here in the blue, and generally believed to be caused by titanium 2 coming in at, well, generally after maximum. You can see some evidence here before maximum, but then around maximum, the titanium 2 really comes in, and there are several other titanium 2 features out there in the blue as well. But clearly, type 1A supernovae has the sulfur 2 W here. And nickel, cobalt, and iron. They have low luminosity, as I'll show you. They have cool photospheres. The titanium 2 is a clue, but they're also very red in color, partly because of titanium 2 line blanketing, but also probably because they're a little cooler in the outer layers, and they have low expansion velocities. Okay, so light curves, some typical light curves, 91T, a very slow decliner, very bright, more normal light curve, and then 92A, slightly faster than normal, but still considered a normal supernova, and then 99BY, a 91T-like, down here, several magnitudes below normal, and a much faster decliner, and so I will use something. In fact, I think I took a Leeuwengut light curve and stretched it here in order to match these observed light curves. So you can use stretch, or you can use delta M15B, the number of magnitudes the supernova declines 15 days after maximum, or some other parameter for the light curve shape. And from that 99BY paper, we've taken the Phillips relation, which for these normal type 1As here running in delta M15, from like 0.8 to 1.5, 1.6, and we added a group of, well, fast decliners out here, and we got their brightnesses either because they were in the Hubble flow, or in the case of 99BY, it was so close that we needed a Cepheid distance, and Macri et al. Published the Cepheid distance to 99BY galaxy, NGC 2841, and you see that you can extend the Phillips relation down. You need to really bend it a lot. You need to make it an exponential instead of kind of a quadratic fit to get these faint guys on the Hubble diagram. But you can actually even use these for distance measurements. We went and measured the Hubble constant based on these fast decliners and got something reasonably the same as the brighter type 1A supernovae. You can also see that the Phillips relation gets less steep as you go to longer and longer wavelengths, becoming nearly flat, and I'll show you in a second that in the infrared, this relationship between brightness and decline rate becomes nearly completely flat, except for the most extreme 91BG likes. Okay.
How do you get a whole constant when you put it in there, get the magnitudes?
Like I said, there's two ways of doing it. Generally, if you use the Hubble flow, then the absolute magnitude depends on what you assume your Hubble constant to be. But we can at least make a relative brightness plot like this, and then you can just move that up and down depending upon what your favorite Hubble constant is. But because we got a Cepheid distance to 99BY, that, if you believe the Cepheids give you an independent distance, then that fixes one of these guys, and then we just can adjust our Hubble constant until we get the best fit line to that. And because there aren't that many of them, we didn't get a really strong constraint, just a consistency check. Okay, so this is something I did last night because I'd never seen it before, realizing when I was talking to Dan how much you have to really bend that Phillips relation in the B band in order to get it to fit the faint supernovae. What I did is all I did was turn it into a linear plot. So this is now peak luminosity in ergs per second per angstrom, 10 to the 39 here. So instead of magnitudes, now it's just luminosity. And in the B band, you see that the Phillips relation here is preserved. And then these really faint guys are really, really faint. I mean, magnitudes sometimes fool you, but you know, it's a factor of 6 here from these bright guys down to these 91 BG likes. And then we fall off the line here where we actually have zero flux. So these guys are getting very, very faint. And in fact, it may be a selection effect. Maybe there are even fainter ones down here. I can't say, but maybe Peter will tell us.
I will have a statement on that.
Okay. And here from Kevin Christunis's work, JHK, so the infrared 1.2 to 2 micron Phillips relation, delta M15B here, and absolute magnitude. And you can see it's pretty darn flat here in the J and the H and K, except for the really extreme ones. And even here, the variation is not very great. You can see this is 18.5 versus 18 compared to that huge variation here in the B band. So while they are extremely faint in the optical, they're not that different than the general pack in the infrared. Okay, and again, the other Peter is going to talk more about rates and things like that, but this is from Saurabh Jha's work recently looking at the local sample of supernovae, and these were taken willy-nilly, basically from the IAU circulars and things like that, and they got light curves and studied them at the CFA, and this is the distribution of delta M15B that came out of that, and you can see that they are down there in number compared to what you could call normal supernovae. This span here, and there are fewer of them here. What the actual rate comparison is, and how that breaks down versus galaxy, we can hope Peter tells us. But Weidong Li et al. From the KATE survey claim that about 16% of type 1As are 91 BG-like from their earlier stuff. That was way back in, I don't even remember, 2001 or something like that. So probably they have a better rate now.
The 91 BG-like ones are delta M15 greater than 1.8 or so?
I would say, yeah, 1.8, 1.7 is... They're
around 1.5 is not...
I would not say that's an enhancement. That was just... This is something we use just to make simulations where we took a Gaussian here to try to fit that and then a Gaussian here, and what the real distribution is, I couldn't tell you.
But I think they also overlap with this peculiar spectral features. People use this 1A peck. Is that not
I think 1A peculiar is a tough thing to say because these are the extreme type 91 BG likes, but there is a continuum. If you look at this line ratio, silicon 2 at 6150 versus silicon 2 or whatever it is, some people say it's something else. I think that's probably wrong now. In fact, I said it, but it's probably silicon 2. And if you look at this line depth ratio as a function of delta M15, there's a fairly nice linear connection between what would you call the normal ones and the 91 BG-like. So it's difficult to say. There is a break when it comes to color, and I'll show you that in a second, that often they were these are red, and so we can throw them out of the normal range. But I think that's still a result of titanium tube blanketing and a cooler atmosphere, and maybe Dan can tell us more about that. Okay. We looked at silicon 2 velocities here. So this is the velocity of the minimum of silicon 2 versus time days from B maximum. So here's B maximum here. And for a range of supernovae, BY and 91 BG are the classic 91 BG likes, 86 G maybe a transition object, and then going in decreasing a delta M15. And what you see is, in general, a very fast decline. We don't have very much data here for the fast decliners. And then a flattening out here of silicon 2. So you could think of this as the photosphere working through the silicon, and then it reaches a point where the silicon becomes detached from the photosphere, and this is sort of the minimum velocity of the silicon. But for these 91 BG likes, you actually get a continuous decline here. So we continue to work through the silicon, and you can imagine the silicon runs very, very deep into these 91 BG likes from this analysis. And we did something crazy, like instead of saying, well, from maximum, why don't we say from explosion? We don't really know the time of explosion, but by taking a stretch factor and stretching the time axis by that stretch factor, we can adjust these velocities. And what you can see is 99BY, 91BG all have lower velocities all the way across. 86G, slightly higher velocity, and then these more normal ones, even higher velocity. So by trying to account for the time of maximum, you could see that the velocity of silicon is always lower at all times for the 91BG likes and the fainter supernovae, and there's a progression up to higher velocity at all times. Okay, and just Paolo is here, so I'm...
At day 45, at the last point, you just got to be too faint to be able to...
Well, it's becoming very nebular and hard to pick out the silicon from the rest of the stuff down there.
Down there at 7,000 kilometers a second. It'd be really interesting to see.
Okay, is there actually a silicon feature at that time? Isn't it kind of gone?
It gets kind of messy. So you could argue that maybe there's, it's harder to see. As I recall, when measuring these, there was still a little dip in the continuum there at the silicon, and I assume that was the silicon and measured the velocity.
But I usually, when I see this, I think it's clear to me. It's just, wouldn't this say that there's less mass in the envelope?
This would tell me nothing about the mass, only that the silicon is at lower and lower velocities, possibly saying...
declining with time.
Just have different decline rates in terms of the rate that
you're seeing in. So isn't that a density statement? It's a density. I don't think it's a mass. It's a passive statement, so depending on how much of the rest you're seeing.
Go ahead.
Okay.
It's a number density
of
silicon 2. That's what it is.
Get different answers from different people. So Paolo is here, so I don't want to say this too much, just to show that from his work, a careful analysis of 91BG, that the iron emission lines at late times are very, very narrow compared to normal type 1A supernovae, and Max's work with Paolo on the nickel 56 production as a function of delta M15B, showing that these 91BG likes produce very, very little nickel 0.1 solar masses compared to the more normal type 1A supernovae. I always like to cover this number. Make it nicer. What did we say that was? 95 AL, I think it is. We'll still have to figure that one out. Whoops. Okay, and we were talking about color. One of the biggest discriminators for 91BG likes is the color of the supernova. Here's the color versus time, the B minus V, corrected for galactic extinction, and normal type 1a supernovae 98aq, and the Liebig-Good template is the dashed line, and then going to faster decliners down here, 92a, and let's see, what else do we have? 98bp, an intermediate type object, and then as you can see at maximum, they just get redder and redder as you go to the faster and faster decliners. And even 10 days after maximum, they can be extremely red compared to their slower declining brothers. Another way of looking at this is B max minus V max as a function of delta M15B. And Phillips found a fairly shallow relationship for the normal type 1As. But when you hit about a delta M15B of 1.6, 1.7, suddenly you fall off this edge here, and the supernovae at max get very, very red very quickly. And in fact, this is a better way of measuring the luminosity. This correlates very well with the luminosity of the supernova, and it's steep compared to the fairly small range of delta M15B. So you can actually use the color for these guys as a substitute for a decline rate when measuring luminosity. Okay, so this is kind of why they were called peculiar. Anything that was redder than this was either reddened or one of these 91 BG likes, and a very convenient way of cutting it out of the sample and getting only the normal unextinguished type 1A supernovae. Okay. Something I showed a while back, this is from Malcolm Hicken's work at CFA, a fairly large set of type 1A supernovae that they're studying, and this is projected galactocentric distance. So I'm moving now into host galaxy properties in these guys, and the 91 BG likes here are concentrated down at fairly small galactic centric distance. This is a mixture of all sorts of host galaxies, spirals, and everything else. But what's clear is these 91 BG likes are fairly close in to the host galaxy. I'm not sure exactly what that means. This black point is something even more peculiar than the 91 BG like. It's a new 2005 HK, even stranger object.
It's Wilmer spiral.
Yeah, I know. And I wish Bob was here to take more credit for it. But so this is Malcolm Hicken's work, and I take absolutely no credit for it, but he was nice enough to give me the view graph. And it was at the AAS meeting, he showed this as well, and I saw the very nice correlation. Maybe it's just luck with this set, but it does show up very well.
A huge observational bias for finding the faint ones that close in.
A bias against it.
Against it.
Yeah.
So it's even more remarkable.
Yeah.
This is the nearest sample.
Yeah.
Yeah, but even still, it's a little blob right here in the nucleus. It's much harder to find. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for spirals, that just would indicate that they're associated more with an older population.
Right.
So that'd be consistent with a lot of luminosities and elliptical.
Well, we're going to see more of that. So, originally, Mario Homoy plotted this up for the Kalantalolo set, and Joe Gallagher did it for a larger set here. This is a morphological type versus delta M15B, and we can see that for spirals, most of the supernovae are what you'd call normal or even a little brighter, and for ellipticals and S0s, most of them are falling in the faster declining range, and down here where you would call these 91 BG likes, you see that again there aren't very many of them up here in the spirals, but they run a range from, you know, SB down to very strong elliptical type galaxies.
Well, I remember, Peter, when you were here maybe 2 years ago, showed this plot. We played this game of me asking where those two were, that were in the spirals, were they in the halo or the disk? The two that are in the SAB.
These.
I thought the answer was they were both in the halo.
Well, one of these, I didn't look where the other one was, one of these is 99BY, which happens to be in this SB galaxy, and it was right about here in the disk, of the galaxy, and I think my answer to your question was, this looks like a nice spiral galaxy and was classified as an SB. When you take the spectrum of it and the integrated spectrum of the whole galaxy, you see something that looks more like an elliptical.
This is the H
alpha emission, which is very, very small and very little other emission. So despite it being a spiral, it has low specific star formation rate going on. And in fact, I think people, this is a knot image, a very nice high resolution, good seeing knot image. This is the SDSS image of the galaxy, and I think they kind of stretch things to emphasize the blue stars in this. Here, it looks kind of boring in color and what's going on. You'd almost mistake it for an elliptical if you were just going pretty fast. And they do a very nice stretch for color here for these SDSS. You know, this nice big red thing, and when things are blue, they're really, really blue. But this is just kind of a bland greenish. Anyway, I don't know what that means. So,
do you remember where 57A was?
I don't remember where 57A was. So,
yeah, that's another one.
So despite it being an elliptical, there was actually two supernovae in two 91 BG likes in this galaxy, 57A and 99 BY.
So they're both in the same distance out, just separated by 25 degrees if you come off of the center there. So
I'm not sure what that means, but
follow the angle around. They're
I just mean two.
There's ultra radio jet there. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
It's a fascinating galaxy.
Yes. And it's interesting where the supernova took place with respect to the radio jet as well. But that's
Okay, so, and I've shown this before here as well. So this is, now we've flipped, turned things around. Delta M15B, the decline rate parameter here versus the ratio of the current to past star formation rate, basically the H-alpha equivalent width of the host galaxy. And what you see is a scattering here of normal supernovae running out to fairly high current star formation rates, but also occurring at low star formation rates as well. But these 91 BG likes, and there's a nice little clump of them here with upper limits and things like that. This guy here with the actual detection of H-alpha is 99 BY galaxy, but you can see it's a very low star formation rate galaxy. There's just none of these 91 BG types out here in the moderate to high star formation rate region. So again, this is not telling you rates or anything like that. It's just saying that these 91 BG like seem to like to occur in fairly low star formation rate old population galaxies.
The idea is that anything that can happen in an old population should be able to happen in a spiral galaxy where there may be lots of star formation going on, because they also, spirals also contain old populations.
Yes,
so
but
if you look at a large population of spirals, why don't you see these same types of supernovae?
I think the question is how much of an old population do you get by adding these guys up versus looking at some large elliptical and
how many you need, I suppose, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so it's a problem that this is just too few galaxies?
I'll show a plot that shows you the relative K-band mass of the sample so that you get a very good idea of what that shocking.
As I tell the techs, this is clearly too few galaxies, so we need to study more of them. Yes, and probably we'll find a few of these fast decliners in here eventually, but we'll just build up more and more of these as well. Okay, and also in the talk last week, I mentioned work Joe Gallagher is doing now on early type galaxies, trying to measure the metallicity and age from stellar models, fitting those galaxies, grids of these galaxies, and then putting the host galaxies of type 1A supernovae on the grids to try to estimate the age and metallicity of the dominant population. You see, we have some problems with some of the galaxies, and we're trying to work these out. So this is rather preliminary, but if we keep our plot to reasonable ages changes in metallicities, we find that these normal type 1a supernovae are occurring in relatively early young populations, but these 91BG-likes, and these are certainly 91BG-like, this is Z magnitude, so 91BG-like kind of brightnesses are occurring in the older 10 to 15 or more giga-year populations. And as I also showed, not very much correlation with metallicity. In fact, I was looking at this earlier and I was puzzling why exactly these 91BG-likes are occurring in a fairly small range of metallicity compared to the normal type 1a supernovae, and that may be something you'll we'll try to figure out, probably simply because there are all the older population galaxies and have, for some reason, a narrower range of...
How's that consistent with your galaxy?
Yeah, we'll have to look at that.
You have the plot with the distance from the center of the galaxy, and you're interpreting that in terms of metallicity, aren't you?
I wasn't. This is the first time I've mentioned metallicity today. Oh yeah, yeah. Don't read the words. Just look at the pictures. At one time I was trying to figure out. Well, I've been arguing against metallicity for some time observationally, and in general, the metallicity should go up as you go into a galaxy, and there are models that suggest maybe higher metallicity means fainter supernovae, and so maybe that works in this case. The higher the metallicity, maybe you're getting,
but not that extreme. Not that extreme.
Not that extreme. Yeah. Okay. So that's about all I had as an introduction to 91BGs.
So should we take a little break? Everybody's nodding their head yes. Okay, so let's back in 5 minutes.
Oh, we're going to have a conference.
1885A.
So I'm going to pick up where Peter left off and describe some of the interesting host galaxy properties for the 91BG-like supernova and the relative rates too, which is quite interesting once you start looking at it. So once again, you saw this, how much down they are, the light curves and the spectral differences. And here's a zoom in, and this is the definition of 91BG-like, is the presence of this. And as Peter showed, it really takes off in color when this comes in. And I think Dan will explain very nicely in his talk why this comes in and where it comes in. So this is 99BY in absolute R-band magnitude. As Peter said, there was a Cepheid distance to that galaxy. And what I want to show here are two things. First is the Kate search has a very nice cadence. They try to go back every 5 days to the galaxy. They're searching basically the RC3 catalog plus a handful of other objects. And there's a very good non-detection point here at day minus 17.6 with respect to R-band peak. And remember, R-band peak's about 2 or 3 days after the B-band. So the rise time here is about 12 days in B-band. You can constrain it very nicely. These are points coming from amateurs and Kate, where they recovered the supernova after it was discovered right there. And so you can get a very, very good constraint on the rise time of these things. And very much like Peter showed in his graph of just using stretch to move up, these do fit that. Over the first, say, plus or minus 20 days around peak.
Is this the best one for pre-R-band
This is one of the best, this is the best 91BG like, absolutely. No question, this non-detection here. Now also look at the other thing. This is, so this galaxy is relatively nearby. They got a Cepheid distance to it. But in Weidong searches, he doesn't go much farther out than about two more magnitudes in distance modulus. Okay? So he will typically be sensitive to objects to around an absolute magnitude of minus 14. This is very interesting because if we hold to this idea of perhaps age is related to nickel mass, well, you wonder, well, you know, can we probe something that's older that even has less nickel mass? And you can run simple models, and if you get a nickel mass of, say, 0.07-ish, 0.06-ish for 99BY, you could drop down to 0.03, and Weidong would have found these guys already. So they don't exist. That I postulate that those supernova don't exist.
With duration of 20 days.
Yeah, they would rise and fall within his cadence, and he would see them on a few epochs, and he would absolutely submit a circular. Now, he may think it's not, you know, may think it's a galactic thing along the line of sight, but somebody would ID it, and somebody would take a spectrum of it. Until you start getting down to 0.02, 0.01, so we're really sort of petering out here at about 0.06, okay? I don't think there are any 1As. Now, it's just a claim, but this is very conservative for what Weidong's limit is. Okay, so I think that's interesting. Perhaps these supernova are representative of the oldest objects in the universe. There's a thought, or tied to it in some way. So I talked about this in the talk at the conference about the biases and the searches at low Z, and this is the thing that I just pointed out, that Kate goes very deep. Catch them very early and find faint supernova and bright hosts, unlike the other searches which are not pointed. And so here is a mapping. The red are the 91BGs, K-band absolute magnitude here, and the number of supernova. Conversely, here are the 91T-likes that are found in the RC3 catalog. So here I'm going to get into the relative rates and what's going on. RC3 is a very biased catalog to do your search in. Okay, this is the number of galaxies, B minus K, color. So here are the ellipticals and S0s. I've lumped them all into this last bin right here. So, you know, huge factor. But this doesn't represent all of it, because the galaxies that are very red tend to be the biggest galaxies mass-wise, too. So I factored both these things into here. And if you look at the RC3 catalog and convert the K-band absolute magnitude into a mass, a relative mass, and then scale it. So this is getting back to your question here. It's 100,000 times more is your typical galaxy than the ones which are producing the bulk of, you know, the very overluminous one. And compared to the normal 1As, which sort of float around all over here, you're two orders of magnitude. So you would have to search, typically, two orders of magnitude more galaxies that are the SBs.
Okay, so something doesn't make sense to me. So
yeah.
The two-mass paper, Janet paper, for example, you give the K-like densities. My memory was that in spirals, the K-like density, the spirals were responsible for about one-third of the local K-like density.
Well, this is just the RC3 catalog, so put that bias in there.
Okay.
So I'd
okay.
So I'm saying for Weidong,
yes,
to do a search. This is not necessarily what it's like in the, so maybe it's just an order of magnitude in the real world, right? Because you're saying it's more like a third or something like that. Right. 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 So if, but for Weidong, it's incredibly heavily biased by more than that, a lot more than that.
So can you remind us how the RC3 catalog was constructed?
What are the biggest galaxies in the sky? Okay, that's it. It's a radio catalog. It's a radio catalog, and these were the largest. And it was constructed, I don't know, 50s, something like that, when the first radio telescopes were popping on. So it's just the biggest sources. So once again, heavily favoring the redder galaxies, and there's not much overlap here. So the next thing, this is the interesting part. Now we can start comparing relative numbers here. So looking just at the ellipticals in S0, so in some way here I've taken out the mass part, 13 are 91 VG-like compared to 16 normal ones. Okay, it's almost 50-50 ratio between the two if you confine yourself to the ellipticals and S0s that we know. If you pop up to the SA and SBs, which is the only other types of galaxies for which 91 VGs have been found, you get 3 91 VG-like and 57 are normal. Okay? So, clearly there's an evolution here. Okay? It's not just mass. Okay? So, 91 VGs are tied to something that's evolving. And this comes from this this paper. There are two papers by Vandenberg, Lee, and Filipenko, and this is the second one, and the numbers come straight from there. So, so that this is, to me, I think, the smoking gun about the relative populations. And so I like this, and I am now wondering, as if we've hit something, hit a wall over here. There'll be a couple more searches coming up next year. The Palomar transient factory that Sri Kulkarni is starting. He wants to do a 3-day cadence. So it'll be very, very good at picking out anything that rises and falls very quickly. But I think, as you see from Dan's models, even if we push the nickel mass down a little bit lower, Wei Deng should have been finding these guys already. It'd be very interesting to see if there's either a limit from the explosion model set, no matter what, you're going to produce 0.05 of a solar mass of nickel. Otherwise, you don't have an explosion. That could be one thing. The other thing could be the universe isn't just old enough yet to produce these guys. That could be another thing. So I'll leave it there and then bring Dan to muddy the waters completely by trying to convince you that they could be subchandra sekhar.
Very good.
So Peter?
Yeah.
In the SBSCs, where there are a few.
Yeah.
They obviously are happening in a population that's not as old. So they can't happen.
So this, I think, gets back to the question, you know,
how what? You look at a galaxy, clearly there's a distribution of age in the galaxy. So is it just, and remember, morphology is not the best way to characterize age. So one of the things we should do is go back and look at just those three examples and say, where did you occur in the galaxy? Does your galaxy have a very old time? So Peter showed that spectrum of NGC 2821. Sure, it had some Cepheids in it, but it's a magnitude minus 25, 26 galaxy. It's huge. Okay? So,
it's not very halos, too.
Just how low a nickel mass see something that you have a chance of calling a type 1A?
So I think you'd probably go down to 0.03.
Well, that depends, yeah. For a total ejected mass of 1.
Yes.
If the ejected mass is very low, you can go very low.
You could probably go lower. But so what Wei Deng would have found already, my guess, is an ejected mass around 1, around the Chandra Sekhar mass, probably 0.03. He probably could have found those. Much lower than that. If you lower that total ejected mass, you probably could have gone a little bit lower.
Do you think people would follow them up on it?
Absolutely. No, I mean, that's one of the great things about the Cape searches. Once they find something, anything, and it's extragalactic and they hit it, there are usually a lot of people right after it.
So. I think you were saying also that he hasn't seen anything much below 0.15. So, I think there was a sort of case being made that we might be running out, you know, that there's nothing being discovered between 0.12, 0.15, and 0.03, which is what he would have seen. So maybe there aren't anything.
Yeah, there. Maybe there's a wall, and this could be either due to explosion mechanism or age or what.
So would you expect that as you go higher in rich, you would see the distribution of the 10-15 getting narrower?
So let's say it's very much tied to age, mm-hmm. and we need things that are 10 gigayears old to do this. SNLS and Adam Reese's search at high redshift
certainly probe, you know, well, Adam's probed maybe two little galaxies yet to get anything good. Then again, he found 8 in ellipticals. That's interesting. Not a single one of them was a subluminous one. SNLS does survey enough sky out to a redshift of 0.4. Now, granted, that's not that much time back, but it shaves off a couple of big years. They're going to go back through this year and do a photometric search to see if they find any 91 BG lights. So far, nothing that they have found fits that class at all.
But isn't Sloan, I think Peter's in Sloan, going to Sloan's going to do this, right?
So Sloan has one.
Sloan has one, but as I said, it's fewer than I was expecting, and it may be that we're biased against it because of our need to get spectra quickly, and so people can go through and see if, and they're going through now, seeing if there are fainter ones in there that we could, you know, get light curves on. But it's not clear to me that this is not just a bias, because they are very, very faint.
Now, the other thing is, remember, though, you showed the graphs there, towards I-band, they get very similar in brightness. So if you're searching an R&I, it's not as bad nearby.
I only have about, okay, that's great. I only have about 5 slides or so it'll be quick. And I'm not going to try to convince you of anything, really. I'm just going to, I'm just going to quickly address this question that came up in some of our talks, which is, could some of these subluminous things be subchandra? And so this is just stuff I did the last day or so, quick models that we can all talk about. Basically, just taking a normal kind of Chandrasekhar mass model that seems to work and scaling it down to lower masses. And since there's not actually a model out there of subchandra that seems to be appropriate, just scale down a Chandra model. And actually, the velocities you get from a model, right, is just goes like square root of energy over mass. So it goes like square root of the mass burned over the total mass. And so if that ratio is constant, then the velocity structure doesn't really depend upon the mass. It just depends on this ratio. So I kind of held that fixed, say 80% of the star got burned, no matter what the mass. And then these all have low nickel masses, 0.07. So this is B-band light curves from 0.8 solar masses of ejecta to a Chandrasekhar mass. So not really that surprising. The less mass you you peak earlier, you peak a little brighter. So this is an expression of Arnett's law that, you know, if you imagine the radioactive decay law, if you peak earlier, you're brighter. So the rise time here is about, 14 days or so for this one, and about longer, 18 days or so for the Chandra mass. So and the decline rates here, so the sub-Chandra was at 2.0 delta M15 of B, and the Chandra was at about 1.8 or so. So we're kind of in the range of these subluminous objects. So it's the peak magnitude here. And so then I just took the R-band. This is one example of comparing to these. These are Peter's observations of 99 BY. And so the sub-Chandra fits it really quite well. I didn't really play around with anything. I tried a few different nickel masses and different total masses, but...
But only
but took
2 years
to go. It took one day, so...
Large.
So there you go. Okay, and the Chandra one, it's too broad, but I wouldn't read too much into that because there's still other parameters to play with, so I could increase the explosion energy, say, have it burn a little more mass, and that would make it a little narrower. If you mix nickel, you can also make it a little narrower. So I wouldn't say that, you know, you rule out a Chandra mass. I could probably fit it as well, but the sub-Chandra just fit it pretty well. Also the B and V bands, so I just showed the R band there. And then the spectrum at maximum light compared to 91 BG, the prototype. And again, this is not... So this is the 0.8 solar mass model, and it fits it pretty well, actually very well. I'm surprised. So you get this ratio, you get this titanium. I mean, I didn't play around with the
you know, I didn't tweak this in any way. This is just what comes out of, you put in the model, you run the light curve and the spectra at the same time, and this is what comes out. You get this titanium feature, not quite as strong as the observed, but it's still there. And again, you get the red color, and that's really an effect of the ionization coming in. So I talked about in my talk, once you go below the temperature of 7,000 degrees, you get a lot of blanketing in this region from iron 2 lines. Iron 3 recombines to iron 2, you get a lot of blanketing in iron 2 lines here. And so it's not surprising that once you cross that threshold, when you get about to delta M15 of 1.7 or 1.8, then all of a sudden the colors start getting very red.
So if you convolve that with filter functions, you might be able to match that very rapid color change.
Yeah, exactly. You could probably plot, you know, color change versus ionization or something, you know, temperature, and just see it shoot up.
So one thing, Dan, is it seems like another dimensionless ratio here that might be related to the light curve rise and fall into the spectral properties is the nickel mass ratio to the total mass.
Right.
So if you went up to 0.12, instead of 0.07 for the nickel mass, and went up to Chandra, would it look, how different from this would it look in the light curve and in the spectrum?
Well, let's look.
You get the rise time wrong, that's the problem. You want the low ejector mass, you get the rise time.
I mean, it's the non-nickel mass relative to the nickel mass that's the problem. I mean, if you have Chandra here, you have too much non-nickel outside the nickel mass.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the effect here that there's...
If you, you know, went from 0.07 to 0.12 and 0.15 in nickel mass, mm-hmm. I would have thought you would have had less other stuff outside of it. How much would that...
Right. Yeah. If you increase the nickel mass of this Chandra model, then it would get brighter. And I think you're right. It would peak a little earlier because now nickel is located closer to the surface, and it takes it less time for those photons to diffuse out. And you can sort of do the same effects just taking this nickel mass and mixing it out by hand, saying that it's not concentrated just at the center, some instabilities or something.
I just wanted to be a little cautious about, you know, how strong is the case for it being. Total mass being significantly less than Chandra.
That's as good as the case of this chart.
Yeah, I think that's the way to say it. So here the rise.
Half whole, half, and so
right.
What's against Chandra exposure?
Well, so this is from the point of view, what I'm saying, point of view of light curves. Well, from the point of view in light curves and spectra, there doesn't seem to be much against it for these subluminous objects. So it's a question of the explosion theory saying it's hard to explode something that's sub-Chandra, or at least...
The point is they were supposed to be edge-lit, so which is not what you assume.
Right, yes. So the one calculation... Right.
Some other movement.
Exactly. So if you ignite the helium on top in these edge-lit models, then that burns to nickel, and you'll have a layer of nickel on the outside, which will mess up that spectrum.
But spectrum? Because I found that was a thing that we were 1.4 and we were half of that.
Yeah, so I tried the Chandra model as well, so that same Chandra model at its maximum light, and it looked pretty good too. So it wasn't so much bad. The titanium, I don't think, was quite as strong, but it's still, I think you could still fit it with the Chandra model as well. It just kind of scales with the time, you know. If you go to a lower mass, it sort of looks like the higher mass thing, but happening at an earlier time. So mass sort of scales to time.
There's light curve, if you go back.
Yeah.
As an observer, you don't know when the explosion happened. So we really put them all at the time of maximum, and I bet they would look a lot more similar because their widths and things are harder to discriminate there.
If I normalize how they plot this, Steve. Did I do that on the next plot? So this is the R band. So you do see a difference. So yeah, so this you can tell. So here's this is just a lower limit point, right?
No, that one's down.
This is actual point.
That's an actual observation.
So these points don't quite agree. So you have some discrimination there, but not much. But like I said, you can change the parameters of the model, I'm sure, to make that rise time a little shorter. So I wouldn't say this rules out, but maybe there are diagnostics in here. Maybe there's diagnostics in the spectra, for example, looking at how these, I mean, I can do this later, see how these silicon velocities evolve. We'll have the whole time series of spectra, so just see if it, there's a difference in chandra, subchandra. Maybe there's something in here somewhere that will be a stronger discriminant.
Latent sinusular spectra, like Paula did. I think combining all of those, then you can probably put these constraints on.
Yeah. The problem, of course, is there's not a you know, first principles explosion model that, so it's still unconstrained by all the playing around you can do. Yeah, it's just that it's, how do you constrain the problem to which set of parameters to look at? For example, I mean, I just played this game of, well, could a normal type 1A be subchandra? Well, it can't be too subchandra because a normal type 1A has 0.6 solar masses of nickel, 0.2 solar masses of IME at least to get the spectra. So it has at least 0.8, but you take a 0.1 solar mass object with 0.6 nickel and some silicon, yeah, it kind of fits the spectrum all right. Maybe you're seeing a little titanium in there, maybe that's not observed, but yeah, you could fit a normal type 1A with something less than a chandra circum mass, so not too much less. Oh, and then, well, if we're going subchandra, let's just go really subchandra. Why not? Just do it. Just scale it down to 0.1 or so on. I don't know how to construct these models necessarily, so I just kind of did the same thing. It's an exponential density versus velocity. These numbers here, this is total mass, this is nickel mass. So these black ones are just pure nickel balls. It's all nickel 56, and these are half nickel, half helium and silicon and stuff like that. So here is sort of what you predict. I think it's sort of what Lars was thinking. The rise times are, you know, 4 to 8 days or something. So yeah, I guess what Peter was saying, we could probably rule out these 0.1, 0.05. These got pretty bright, actually. Got up to almost minus 18. But maybe with 0.01, maybe those wouldn't have been seen. I don't know.
But I think this is very good, you know, if you sort of have a regular blend of nickel and their intermediate mass, we would have found a 0.025. I mean, we would have found something like that already, if they exist with any number density, because they're above absolute magnitude minus 14 for 15, 20 days.
With an ejected mass is 1. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, the ejected mass here was very low. That's true.
It really matters for the duration.
Yeah, so if you have a little nickel and a lot of ejected mass, you'll get a broader, dimmer thing.
Yeah.
That's the trade-off that has to be done. It's a good point. Very good point.
They would recognize that as a type 1A. The question
not
is, how many of these types of things could there be that we just don't know or don't know? Are there genuine
ones? I don't think, so Wadham's about the only person who can do it, and I don't think anybody's fed him a model like this today to do that. But he can absolutely put this in, that same type of analysis to keep it.
Oops. Yeah, so. And then I just made these plots this morning, but these are what the spectra of some of those models would look like. So we could see if what it would look like. If it's pure nickel, it looks kind of weird. It's just this kind of, I don't know what, if anything like that's ever been seen. This is kind of nickel and helium. If it has sort of the same velocity, you know, distribution as a normal type 1A, it kind of looks like a type 1A happening earlier. So, you know, kind of hard to see, but this is silicon lines. It's not that different than a normal type 1A, actually, at its peak, but the peak is happening much earlier.
The thing out of 3,000 ancient, that's just a hole in the capacity.
This thing here?
Yeah,
I think there's broad blanketing from cobalt and iron here, and then there happens to not be as many lines there, so some flux leaks out. But at least we can maybe have some set if anyone observes anything weird. Maybe we'll go to the models. Here it is. All right. I think that's all I had.